Okay, folks, we're going to begin. I thank you for coming out tonight. And I was on the Alpha Retreat this weekend, which was fun. I'm there for the answer questions person. So anyone can ask any question they have to stump the pastor kind of thing. But Pastor Jerry helps me, and we had a guy named Eric Moore help me. But Eric was there, and based on the fact that this past week was the celebration of what major Christian event? Anyone? 500 years ago. The Lutheran here should know it.
The Reformation?
Yes. Specifically, though, nailing the 95 Theses onto the Wittenberg door. So this is a shirt he gave me. It's a picture of Martin Luther. Nailed it. So I thought that was cute. He said after he saw it, he could not resist getting it for me as just kind of a way of remembering the Reformation. And by the way, if you don't know this, the Reformation is viewed as one of the most important historical events in history in terms of transformation of culture. This is secular. You go to any university, they will point it out as one of the most pivotal moments. They see it as crucial for the Renaissance, you know, for free thinking. The printing of the Bible was an earthquake on civilization in terms of the printing press. Why was the printing press made? To make the Bible known. Why was it wanting to be distributed? Because suddenly the Bible was available for everyone. It just transformed so many things. And it transformed the Catholic Church. Because the Catholic Church, when they got serious critique for the first time, they realized we can't go on this way. So they had to make serious adjustments in their own doctrine in relation to the Reformation. So very, very important and pivotal event. So with that in mind, though, let's go into our quiz. And let's see here. Okay. If somebody calls you a Nimrod, you have been A, complimented, B, thought of as a mighty warrior, C, insulted, D, considered a member of the winning team. I'm actually only looking for C. The reason why in our culture it only has a negative connotation. You Nimrod. Nobody says that and means, oh, you're a mighty warrior. No, they mean you're an idiot. Now, it is true in our text that he is a mighty warrior. So, if you need to give yourself blessings and credit for that, you can, because it is based on the text. But in our culture, the phrase is not a positive. You're a Nimrod, you're an idiot.
Is this my license to accept
it
as a
Bible quiz? What was that? Is this a Bible quiz? Yes, it is a Bible quiz. Apparently a few people marked that. So for those who needed to put B, you can give yourself grace. But I was thinking of somebody on the street calling you a Nimrod, you probably wouldn't say, thank you so much. I'm grateful for that.
Now.
Now you can be insulted, okay?
So if you thought of as a mighty warrior, you're also being complimented. So you got A, B, and C.
Well, maybe they're anti-war and they're calling you a mighty warrior. You warmonger! So that's not a compliment. Number two. Uncovering your father's nakedness is an idiom for A, sex with your father. B, seeing your father naked. C, seeing your mother naked. D, sex with your mother. No, it's actually D. It is D because that is what the idiom, and this is not a debatable one. This is actually what the idiom is. What you have to decide in the passage that we wrestled with, and that was, you know, why is Noah cursing the Canaanite or Canaan? That you can argue, is this an idiom at play or is nakedness at face value nakedness? But the idiom in Hebrew is from Leviticus chapter 18. You look at any translation and you will see it actually refers to sex with your mother. Now, by the way, there are all kinds of descriptions in Leviticus. It's talking about sex with your kids, sex with your parents. It's going both ways, but that's the idiom. So the idiom is not debatable. We know historically what that idiom is, and the book of Leviticus answers it. Now, whether that idiom should be applied with the story of Noah cursing Canaan, that's debatable. That's, you know, what was that interesting conversation. But the idiom is not. So that makes some sense, since everyone got tripped up on that question. Okay. The word Babel is related to A, confuse, B, brick, C, Babylon, D, disobedience. It is A and C. A and C. However, B and D are all arguable. So if you got any one of these, I'll give you grace. The reason I say they're all arguable, because this is not considered a place of righteousness. This is a place of disobedience. And so the power of this word, whenever somebody from a Jewish heritage sees this, it's not a good thing. And for anyone from a Christian heritage from this perspective does not view Babel as a place of good. But the word literally means confuse. That's what the word means. And Babylon has the same Hebrew letters. But it's distinguished with spelling based on time frame. There was no Babylon at that time. Okay, number four. What does Abram build? A, a family tree. B, an altar. C, a sacrifice. D, a telescope. It is B, perhaps implying C. However, we don't have a sacrifice listed. But he may have sacrificed something. But we do know he gathered together a pile of rocks and put them on top of each other. Now, A and D I put there only for fun, because they actually are true. Abraham is about to have phenomenal amount of descendants, although we have not had that full prophecy yet. All we've had so far is you're going to be blessed and the world is going to be blessed through you. But he is going to have descendants that are like the grains of sand or the stars in the heavens, thus the name telescope. However, we didn't get there yet. So that's your preview. You know, he is building a family tree, a very important family tree. And he is going to need to look at the stars, because God actually says, count them if you can, because your descendants are going to outnumber them. Okay. Five. According to the text, Sarai is A, beautiful, B, childless, C, sickening, D, worth a lot of cattle. It's all of them. All of them. She's absolutely beautiful. She is childless. Pharaoh gets sick when he gets married to her. And she is worth an awful lot of cattle, because that's what Pharaoh pays to get her. So she is all four of them.
Didn't he actually get married to her?
Well, he's broiling the harem. I don't know if they went down the aisle. I do not know that. But Pharaoh viewed him, took him in to be his wife. So maybe there is an intermediary, you know, wait here until we do a formal ceremony. I doubt the Middle Eastern king, though, felt he needed to do that. You just enter the harem and you're good to go. But see, that's, it requires a little thinking here, because you think, sickening? Why would she be sickening? Well, he got sick. Was his sickness related to Abram? No, it was related to Sarai coming into his household. So, yes, it's a little trick question, but we've got to have a little fun, can't we? Okay, six. The name Eber means friend of God, the Lord is my strength, rebel, divided.
Divided.
Divided. And we actually talked about that at two classes. Because
his P-Leg.
Excuse me?
I thought that was P-Leg.
That's his son. In other words, he was, the Eleb's name means divided, and then he had two sons. But in the second genealogy, only Peleg shows up. And that is, but it's his name that means divided, not Peleg.
Oh.
Okay, number seven. The primary purpose of the story of Noah cursing Ham is A, the evilness of humanity. B, the rejection of Ham's line, meaning his descendants. C, Noah's drunkenness. D, the elevation of Shem and Japheth's lines.
B and D.
I would see A, B, and D. A, B, and D. The fact that Noah was drunk is interesting. We can argue whether or not that was an indictment of sin on his part, but we can say with confidence that we have already seen that God has stated that evil is bound up in the heart of man, and that is post-flood. And then this incident happens a paragraph later. You know, it causes you to pause and say, yeah, this is an example of evil. And then it is most assuredly a rejection of Ham's line and the elevation of Shem and Japheth, although the division of which of those two is going to be the one of the seed of woman that's going to bring salvation is not yet determined, but it's leaning to Shem or Japheth now. So I would argue A, B, and D. Eight, the book of Genesis, in the book of Genesis, east becomes a metaphor for peace. B, resurrection. C, second coming. D, moving outside of God's purposes.
It is D.
Second coming is tempting because there's a New Testament reference of the Eastern Gate, and you know, that's supposed to seduce you and think, oh, it must mean that. But not in Genesis, not yet. Okay, number nine. Who may need some marriage counseling? Abel, Milcah, Enoch, Sarai.
D.
I would say D. If your husband's willing to hand you off that quickly, there is some counseling here necessary. I mean, this is not good. I think Sarai deserves a little mercy here. And maybe this is why she gets a little bitter later on, you know, sleep with my handmaiden, because you're willing to pawn me off in a second. You know, it's a fascinating observation. All right, number 10. The story of Abram in Egypt foreshadows what?
The Jews in Egypt.
The Jews in Egypt and their exodus. Yes. So they actually, when they left Egypt, they plundered. That's the word. They plundered the Egyptians. They actually left with all kinds of goodies. Abraham did the same thing. Pharaoh was just like, get out of here. Keep all the stuff I gave you. So in both cases, there is a plundering. In both cases, there is a plague. There's a lot of little similarities between these events. Okay. 10 out of 10. I'm doubting it on this one. By the way, I have to say, I always ask this question, as you know, how'd everyone do? You guys are always better than Manhasset. Always. You either lie more or you're actually better than they are. But at 9 out of 10? Okay, good, good. 8 out of 10? All right, then we're pulling together here. Yeah, it was a harder quiz. Some tricky questions there. Nothing really funny. You know, I like when I write a question that people like burst in laughter. But nothing of that sort.
We weren't seeing that today.
Say it again?
We weren't seeing any of that today.
No, I guess it's a cruel quiz. All right, let's dig into our text. And this is one of these passages which I personally dread reading because it has lots of names and I don't expect to get them all right here. But We'll give it a whirl. Is something happening?
No, it's
fine. Oh, okay.
I'm just going to give a tiny bit of
tweak. All right, thank you. All right, so let's drop into our text at chapter 13, which has a heading, Abram and Lot Separate. Abram and Lot Separate. So let's read this first chapter. It goes this way. So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with him. Abram had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and gold. From the Negev, he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier, and where he had first built an altar. There Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now Lot, who was moving about with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. But the land could not support them while they stayed together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to stay together. And quarreling arose between Abram's herders and Lot's. The Canaanites and the Perizzites were also living in the land at that time. So Abram said to Lot, "Let's not have any quarreling between you and me, or between your herders and mine, for we are close relatives. Is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. And if you go to the right, I'll go to the left." Lot looked around and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan toward Zoar was well watered, like a garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. The two men parted company. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, look around from where you are, to the north and south, to the east and west. All the land that you see, I will give you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you. So Abram went to live near the great trees of Mamre at Hebron, where he pitched his tents. There he built an altar to the Lord. Okay, let's take a look for a moment of a map to see a little bit of what Abram is doing. So here we got map of the Middle East. Over here is Egypt. You see, this is the Fertile Crescent. There's the Nile River. So this is Abram coming over here. Now he's going back. This area here is called the Negev, and you can see that right there. It's just desert. And one of the interesting things about Israel, by the way, when you go there, who's been to Israel? Okay, it's the size of New Jersey. We do not think of New Jersey as a big state. But what's funny, it's because of where it is, it has areas that are lush and green. It has areas that look like the Grand Canyon. It has areas that are like parched and dry. It is such a diverse geography. And so this is not an area. Excuse me?
And that's just Jersey.
Yes. No oil refineries, you know, as you're crossing over the bridge or anything. But this is why nobody really settles here in the Negev. Beersheba is going to be prominent in a little while, but not tonight. But he goes up to Hebron, which is right here. So I want to show you, when it's talking about Lot and that he settled in the Jordan, that's this area here. Here's the Jordan River. This is the Dead Sea. Jordan River goes up to the Sea of Galilee. So the water flows from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. And because you have a river here, you have a dependable water source for farming and all those kinds of things. Now, interesting point for today. Today, no water flows out of the Sea of Galilee into the Jordan River. And the reason is this is Israel's only water source. And so they do not want to see any water wasted. The water from the sea in the Jordan River now comes actually from this river here, coming from Syria. And that is what populates or fills this with water. These things here, this is a little red, a blue line, That's a wadi, meaning it's usually no water in it at all. Israel does not have a lot of water sources, and so this is a wadi, this is a wadi, this is a wadi. This is an actual flowing river, though, that flows into here. And the reason why is, what happens when the water gets to the Dead Sea? It's useless. It's dead. It's totally salty. Did any of you swim in the Dead Sea? Can you drown in the Dead Sea?
Not easily.
Not easily. You can if you get your butt above your head. Because if you're like stuck in the wrong position, you're going to float. But you need to breathe. So you got to have your, you know, head in the right place. You can sit in the Dead Sea and read a newspaper. You know, just like, you can bring your Kindle out there if you want and read. You will not go under.
You can't sink. It's very hard to sink.
It is very hard to sink. The other thing, it's like swimming in pea soup. It is so thick and pasty feeling. So when you get out, the first thing you want to do is wash.
Is it clean?
And God forbid you have a scratch or a cut. Because you will know it when you go into the water. It will hurt. Anyway, though. So this is where Lot is settling. This is the mountains of Israel right here. It's hard to see on the map, but there's a ridge. And that is where Jerusalem is. If you notice, it says Salem. That is Jerusalem. In our text tonight, it is called Salem, though. And this is about, compared to Jericho, when you go from Jerusalem to Jericho, which is about 20 miles, it's all downhill. Because you're even going from the mountains, and then you're going down. So Lot is settling in this valley, which he's calling a fertile valley because it has the river there. So here's Bethel, and here's Ai, and he was settling in Hebron, which is in this area right over here.
Is that why they're called Hebrews? Because they were settled in Hebron? Hebrews?
I don't know that answer. I do. However, tonight is the text where the word Hebrew comes up for the first time. But it doesn't really give an explanation. It just shows up.
Where is Sodom and Gomorrah? Where would they have been?
We don't know exactly. However, that's going to relate to our text. But right along this area here is this huge salt mountain called Har Sidon. In the old days, tourists used to be able to go into it. And when I say salt mountain, I mean a big mountain, all salt. And when you go into it, there are these like salt caverns that shoot up to the sky. And because salt is kind of a whitish material, the sunlight reflects into it. It's almost like translucent. It's very interesting. But when I went there in 1996, they stopped people from going into it. You still can't go into it. They don't let anyone because of pieces of salt falling down. And they're caves and things. But I thought to myself, I'm traveling 8,000 miles. I'm going in there. I jumped the fence. And I went into the mountain and took a few pictures and then came out. I'm a little boy at heart. I like doing that kind of stuff. And so, anyway, I say this, though, is because some have argued that Har Sidon is the remains of where Sodom and Gomorrah is, and this is related to what happens to Lot's wife. She turns into a pillar of salt. And because of all the salt deposits here, they think maybe, but it's going to play into our text now, because of this little parenthetical statement, which we'll get to in just a minute. So anyway, that's just what I see where he's talking. So he's settling in the mountains of Israel, and Lot is settling in the valley, the Jordan Valley. By the way, the Dead Sea is the lowest place on earth. Just another interesting tidbit, below sea level. You don't get any place on earth lower than the Dead Sea. Okay, so let me go back to our text, and we read this. So Abram went from Egypt to the Negev, the desert, with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with him. Abram had become very wealthy in livestock and silver and gold. Now, the interesting thing, and Lot went with him, that implies that Lot may have gone down to Egypt too. The fact that now Lot is with him, it's hard to say from the text. But it's not mentioning that he was in Egypt. He's obviously not pawning his wife off or anything, at least that we read in the text. But he is now with Abram, and Abraham is really wealthy. From the Negev, he went to the place until he came to Bethel. Now, the first thing that you take note of on these first few verses is, what is Abram's financial status? He's very wealthy. So what does this communicate to us? That God has indeed blessed him. So this blessing that God has promised is evident in this text. It seems like everything Abram's touching is, you know, getting more resources, more blessing of God. So he came to Bethel, which means what?
House of God.
House of God. Woo! Bet meaning house, El meaning God.
Then he works.
And you need a high five there, Wayne?
For myself, my memory works.
Oh, yes. You got a wife there, she can high five you, you know, take care of you. He has a gentle ego. Barbara, take care of him, okay? Needs that. Okay, so he came to Bethel, and then a place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier, and where he first built an altar, there Abram called on the name of the Lord. This is a phrase that shows up three times with Abraham. It shows up in chapter 12, verse 8. It shows up here. And it shows up in chapter 21, verse 33. What does it mean? It seems to mean prayer, praise, request. But the context, there doesn't seem to be that he needs something from God. The context seems to be he wants to pause and honor God because he's wealthy now. He's just wanting to give praise to God for all that he has. It's an interesting phrase. Call on the name of the Lord. Yes.
So you don't think it refers to what Paul says in Romans?
Which is?
Anybody who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved.
Well, he obviously isn't reading Paul at the time, but Paul may be reading Abraham, you know, at the time, in terms of when he sees that. And clearly, Abraham is consistently calling on the name of the Lord, and he is blessed of God. I could at least make those two connections. You'll find that I'm always very, very conservative on my interpretation.
I think
you can make a correlation that Abraham is blessed and he's calling on the name of the Lord. And I think that is something we want to communicate to our families. We call on the name of the Lord in our family. That's what we do. This week, I got a call from a blast from my past. A girl that I dated in college, who I actually put money down in a ring to marry. She shows up in stories from time to time. She's my Italian girlfriend. Her name is Donna. But the reason she called me is because a big kind of thing happened in her life on Saturday. And that was, she has a very good relationship with her former husband. They have a son in common, and they get together once a month, and there's never been any issues with that. So she texts me while she's having lunch that he has now a wedding band on his finger. He got married, and he didn't tell his son, and he didn't tell his former wife. And she said, you know what, I know he's free to do what, you know, he wants to do, but to not tell your son that you got married a month before. And I found it sad. It kind of bothered me because I don't like somebody getting hurt. And I thought that was hurtful, what he did. So I brought it up to Michelle, and we called on the name of the Lord together, on her behalf and on her son's behalf. And I think it's a very beautiful thing to hear my wife praying out loud for, you know, former girlfriend of Steve, you know, kind of thing. But my children have made reference to us that they appreciate that they walk into us praying together all the time, calling on the name of the Lord. And it is anyone observing Abram's life notices he calls in the name of the Lord, and he builds altars. He's an altar builder. And these seem to be altars that may include sacrifice, but they could also be stones of remembrance. These are places where God did something with me, and I'm piling these stones up to remember what is taking place. So there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now Lot was moving about with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. But the land could not support them while they stayed together, for their possessions were so great they were not able to stay together. And quarreling arose between Abram's herders and Lot's. Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land. So what you're dealing is a land that's very congested. Now, if you go to Israel in this particular section, so for those who have been to Israel, this is not that far from Jerusalem. Is that a lush area in your memory? Like, would you call it flowing with water, lots of greenery and things like that? I'll answer it for you. No, it is not. It is like going to a fairly desert-like area. Not that different in some respects than Denver. Semi-arid. So we're not desert, but we're semi-arid. Now the challenge with semi-arid is that there's limited grasses. So if you have lots of cattle, you can't have all this cattle on an area of land that cannot support lots and lots of cattle. So a problem emerged, and apparently it was taken out in the herders themselves beginning to fight with each other. I do take note, who is the one who recognizes the problem and puts his finger on it in this text?
Lot.
Say it again?
Lot.
No. Abram. Yes, I think it is interesting that Abram becomes I didn't get to the verse 8, but it says, so Abram said to Lot, that it's Abram, it shows the character of the man. And also it shows the character of the man. What does he tell him? Pick whatever you want. I'm good. That is an amazing statement. You know what breaks my heart is when I see families fighting over estates. We have a family in the church that, which will remain nameless, but daddy recently died. And within nanoseconds, there's a debate over who's getting daddy's stuff. And that really breaks my heart when I see that. But wow, it is a symbol of your faith if you're not consumed with the provision that you're going to have. So Lot, go wherever you want. I'll go to the other place. Pick whichever one you want. Because it's a sense of faith that God's going to take care of me with whatever I do. By the way, we have another family in our church who I think are really smart. They're alive and kicking, I'm glad to say. But they have delineated, they're a fairly affluent family, they have delineated who's getting everything, including every piece of jewelry that the mom has. So she has some nice jewelry. So one, her daughter-in-law saw her and said, oh, Mom, I see you wearing my necklace. Because it was already defined that she was going to get the pearls or, you know, something like that. But I really compliment this family because when they go home to be with the Lord, everybody knows already Mom and Dad's wishes. There's no gray area. And I think that's a gift to your kids when you do that. So, you know, note to self. The other element, though, is note of Abraham's faith. He God's going to take care of him wherever he goes. So they part company, and Lot looked around, verse 10, and saw the whole plain of Jordan toward Zoar was well watered, like a garden of the Lord. Now, when the garden of the Lord, what does that ring make you think of?
Eden.
Yeah, excuse me, not Eve. it makes you think of Eden, and it's intended to make you think of Eden. In other words, Lot's picking the prime real estate, and he perceives it that way, and Abram's okay with it. Now, what's interesting is that Moses or someone adds this parenthetical statement. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Based on the context of verse 10, what does that imply about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah?
Upcoming.
It's upcoming. But Lot says, oh, it is beautiful. That's where I'll settle. And then a parenthetical statement, by the way, this was before Sodom and Gomorrah happened. The probable explanation is the time of Moses, it's a wreckage. In other words, that place Lot wanted to settle, it's a bomb. The statement doesn't make sense unless it implies that there was, at a time, this land was gorgeous. But now it is desolate and a wasteland. So that seems to be connected why the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah is so, it weighs into here. Because at this point, it also communicates something else, that whoever reading Genesis knows independently about Sodom and Gomorrah. Already knows about Sodom and Gomorrah, which means it had to be one huge story. Because before Moses is even recording it, people know about it. And so he can tell the story about Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 11, so Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan, set out towards the east.
So east, he's moving east? Like
so how do you think? Yeah, that doesn't sound positive. Now, moving into the Sodom and Gomorrah region, what do we think a positive or negative about Sodom and Gomorrah?
Well, this sounds before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, I would say definitely negative.
Yes. So if you want to settle in Sodom...
Is that a definite thing? When it's saying toward the east, like it's intentionally east out of God's will, is that intentionally meant that way? Or just have to be geographically, that's the way he's going?
That's an interesting question. It is to the east. In all of these cases, they are to the east. But it's just interesting, every time it shows up, it is negative. It just causes you to pause and say, you see, the author did not have to put where it is. He could have just said he settled by the Jordan Valley. But the fact that he decides to put east, and we see that Cain settled east of Eden. And you see this ongoing connotation of negative east. It seems to imply that in the text. So, the two men parted company. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain, pitched his tents near Sodom. Verse 13. Now, the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. Now, let me ask a question. Is Lot doing the right thing? Why not?
He's moving where the wicked people are.
Where the wicked people are. Okay. Now, here's one of these interesting examples where I would love to preach a sermon on this. You know, where are you settle? Are you hanging out with the sinners and all that kind of stuff? Where, what we find though, what's the best commentary on the Bible?
The Bible.
The Bible. Thank you, Wayne. In fact, I will come right over.
There you go.
The Bible is the best commentary on the Bible, and here is two passages I just want to draw your attention to. The first is our Lord Jesus, who in Luke chapter 17, verse 26, just as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the days of the Son of Man. People were eating, drinking, marrying, and being given in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark. Then the flood came and destroyed them all. It was the same in the days of Lot. People were eating and drinking and buying, selling, planting, and building. But the day Lot left Sodom, fire, sulfur rained down from heaven and destroyed them all. Now that's somewhat neutral, but it's saying, you know, ultimately Lot left Sodom. But now let's check out Peter as he describes this in 2 Peter chapter 2. For if God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but sent them to hell, putting them in chains of darkness to be held for judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world when he brought the flood on its ungodly people, but protected Noah, a preacher of righteousness, and seven others, if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah by burning them to ashes, and made them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly, and if he rescued Lot, a righteous man, who was distressed by the depraved conduct of the lawless, for that righteous man living among them day after day was tormented in his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he saw and heard. If this is so, how much more will the godly be rescued out of their trials? What is interesting about this particular passage, though, is he really is kind of laying it on thick about what we're seeing here in terms of understanding, is Lot wrong for settling in this? Now, wisdom, as I would say, would still say, don't go there, Lot. Secondly, we have that little metaphor. He settled to the east. Anyone kept reading Genesis is going to pick up on that. The point being made, though, when we look at the New Testament, is be very careful of now throwing our eggs at Lot, because Peter's very quick to call him that righteous man. However, on this logic alone, how was Lot's disposition, according to Peter, living in that area? Tormented in his soul, is what it said. Oh, I want to move to the area where I'm tormented in my soul. You know, it doesn't seem like a wise place for him to go.
Maybe he didn't know until he got there. He just saw the land.
That could be. That could be. It's one of those things that's not overt in the text. But I also have noticed another thing about human nature. We do things sometimes for money and for wealth and possessions that place us in compromising situations. And then in the end, we go, why did we do that? Why did we do that? Because what was his reason? It sounded like to benefit his own home economy. This is the best place to go. Well, Abram seems to be founded on, I'm going to depend on the Lord. So Lot, pick your choice. Wherever you want to go. Wherever you want to go. What I'm seeing here is a tension. Clearly, the New Testament does not see Lot as evil for going there. But I would say it is fair to question Lot's judgment and also to see in Lot somebody who may have placed his wealth-earning capacity over and above the preservation of his family. And, you know, what would be a good choice? How many, you know, tombstones say, I wish I spent more time in the office? You know, very few. The reality is we sometimes reach a point in our life where we go, why did I spend all my time doing this stuff when I shouldn't have? And Lot seems to be a testimony of that.
He wouldn't have moved there to try and save those people, would he have? He wasn't that type of character.
Well, I'd love to see that was the case. It doesn't seem like he's having tremendous influence in that. And I've had this a lot. Ever hear the term missionary dating? Mm-hmm. You date somebody, oh, because I'm going to lead them to the Lord. Usually the opposite happens. They lead you away from the Lord. And when you have that attitude, you just have to be very, very careful as to what you're going to do. You know, one of the things I discovered when I was a young man, 19, 20 years old, I'm in a rock and roll band, and we wanted to play our Christian rock and roll in secular bars. And I actually played in a bar in Huntington called Chelsea's. And, you know, our goal was to play, you know, music that would inspire questions, and then in between songs, we'd talk to them and reach out for Christ. You know what we discovered? This was useless. When you go to a bar to get wasted, are you there to hear the band singer, you know, tell you about Jesus, you know? Thank you. I already got guilty on Sunday, and now you're, you know, it didn't work at all. You know that we found out? We started getting all these gigs at Catholic youth groups. And that was perfect because they were in a church environment. They're expecting something religious. Except because they were Catholic youth groups, they were often unbelieving kids. And we had the chance there to present the gospel. It was actually fruitful. You do have to be careful on this whole missionary dating, you know, when I'm going to put myself in environments that are potentially dangerous for me in terms of, is this going to be good, you know, beneficial? And I think it's why some people are gifted to be missionaries and other people not so much. You know, they're just going to be, it's going to rub off on them in the wrong way.
Now, Steve, you said Lot, we determined that he did things that are sort of negative. He He moved out, set out towards the east, everything like that. But then Abraham lived in the land of Canaan. And who did Noah curse?
Mm-hmm.
Cursed Canaan, right?
Right.
So I don't know, is that good or bad?
Well, it's definitely down line going to be bad for the Canaanites.
Right.
Because they're going to be eradicated. But there's a verse coming up in Genesis which we have not arrived at yet. And the verse is, all this land, Abram, is yours. All of it, but not yet. The sin of the Amorites, which is a general name for the Canaanite people, has not reached the level of my judgment. It would not reach the level of his judgment for another 500 years. But that day was coming. But it was not yet. So, yes, he's in the land of the Canaanites, but ultimately, this is going to be Abram's land, or the land of Israel, which is another name for who?
Jacob.
Jacob, exactly. So, the Lord, verse 14, the Lord said to Abram after Lot had parted from him. Now, that's interesting right there. The Lord held back this conversation until Lot was out of the room. And he says, look around from where you are to the north, the south, the east, and the west. All the land that you see, I will give you and your offspring. Now, this is fascinating in a number of levels. Why did he just say to Lot, go wherever you want, it's yours. And then the Lord steps in and says, by the way, Abraham, it's actually all yours. Everything is going to be yours. So this, it's almost as if God sees Abram in his faithfulness to say, wherever I settle, God will bless. God will take care of us. We'll be fine. And God honors that and says, you know what? You will be fine. I'm giving everything you see to you. All the land you see will be you and your offspring forever. Now, that should be a pause for him, because what do we know about Sarai?
She's childless.
She's childless. So he's getting blessed on his offspring here. And get this, they will be like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Then he gives a command. Go walk the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you. So Abraham went to live near the trees of Mamre at Hebron, where he pitched his tents. There he built an altar to the Lord. This is altar number 3. There are 4 altogether. Previously we had 12, verse 7, chapter 12, verse 7, altar number 1. Then, in the very next verse, altar number 2. And now we have altar number 3. I believe there will be 4 altars. In fact, there will be 4 altars altogether. And in every case, he's not talking about a sacrifice. They seem to... Now, there may have been a sacrifice. I don't want to say there wasn't. But the primary thing seems to be this memorial as to what God did and, you know, what he was doing. Do you have memorials in your life this way? When you pass something, do you think... You know, I do this with my kids all the time. They get so annoyed. They start throwing things at me in the car. We're driving Jericho, and I say, that's where Daddy went to high school, Walt Whitman. And they all roll their eyes because I have told them this 57 times every time we drive. That's where Daddy went to high school. But there was some pivotal moments in my life that happened at Walt Whitman. I mean, I was just, I guess it was 6 months ago, my mother was having her nails done at the McDonald's that's right over there. Not at the McDonald's, but there's a nail salon right next to the McDonald's by Walt Whitman. And I went in and I went to the very place where I fell off my bike and broke my right arm, chipped my 2 front teeth, and tore my mouth open and needed stitches. And I went to this place and remembered, this was a pivotal moment in my life, absolutely pivotal. Before this moment, I was this shy guy, didn't talk to anyone, didn't know any girls or anything like that. After this moment, I come to school the next day, my arm in a cast, my mouth swollen, torn open, missing 2 teeth, and everyone's talking to me, mostly girls. All these Florence Nightingales who want to, like, take care of me.
Whatever it takes.
And I thought to myself, I have never looked uglier in my life. And they're nice to me. And I realize it's not really all about looks. I mean, you need to look adequate, I guess, but I was adequate. And this was like a pivotal moment. I became outgoing. I became comfortable with meeting people. I am now convinced the Lord pushed me off my bike. Or an angel, you know, put your foot out and, you know, because it became a milestone in my life. That little sidewalk where I hit is now for me an altar, in a sense of a place I remember that God did something in my life. And I do make your encouragement to do that with your own kids. So point out this is a significant moment when this happened with mommy or this happened with daddy. This was a real significant thing. You ever watch that Disney Pixar movie? It's where you go into this little girl's brain and they have these little round memory things.
Inside Out.
What is it called?
Inside Out.
And in this, if you ever see that movie with your kids, I know it's old movie now, but they have this thing where they're talking about core memories. What are your core memories? We had a fun family discussion on what each of our core memories are. And it was something that is so important that we never want to forget. And you have to go beyond, oh yes, the birth of my child or, you know, things like that. Those are easy ones. But what were key events that became core memories? These are core memories for Abram, and he doesn't want to forget them. The Lord met me here and said, all this land is mine. That's pretty heavy. Well, let's move on. So at that time, verse 14, let me move up on my screen here. Hold on. Okay. The text is Abram rescues Lot. At that time, now here we got all the crazy names. God help me pronounce them here. Amraphel was the king of Shinar. Arach, king of Elasar. Kedorlaomer, king of Elam. And title king of Goyim. These are the kings that went to war against Bera, king of Sodom. Bersha, king of Gomorrah. Shineb, king of Admah, king of Zeboim, and Bela, that is Zoar. All these latter kings joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is the Dead Sea Valley. So you saw that on the map, the Dead Sea Valley that they went to. For 12 years, they had been subject to Kedorlaomer. And in the 13th year, they rebelled. And in the 14th year, Kedorlaomer and the kings allied with him went out to defeat the Rephites and the Ashtaroth, Karnaim, Zuzites, in Ham, the Emites in Sheva and Kirathem, and the Horites in the hill country of Seir as far as El Paran near the desert. Then they turned back and went to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and there they conquered the whole territory of the Amalekites, as well as the Amorites who were living in Hazeron Tamar. Now, pause for just a second, and you have to ask this question, why are we knowing this? Why is this important? What you need to know primarily is that there is a battle taking place between the kings that are ruling in the mountains of Israel to those that are in the valley of Jordan. And the kings in the mountains of Israel are the ones that are holding sway and holding power. Then the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, marched out and drew up battle lines in the valley of Ziddim against, here's that king that's brought these other peoples together. I will not read those names again. Verse 10, now the valley of Ziddim was full of tar pits, and when the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, which means they were losing the battle, they fled. Some of them fell into the tar pits, and the rest fled to the hills. The four kings seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food. They went away. And here's the key thing. Here's why this is in the Bible. They also carried off Abram's nephew Lot and his possessions since he was living in Sodom. Now, another thing to take note of, when we first read of Lot going into the area of Sodom, is he in Sodom? No, he's near Sodom.
It's just tents outside Sodom, right?
It's interesting, in just a little while later, he's now in Sodom. Now, it's hard to make too much of this, but I can't help but notice this, that it seems that he's made a move into this evil city. Verse 13, a man who had escaped came and reported this to Abram, the Hebrew. Okay, first use of this term in the entire Bible. Is it because he lives in Hebron? Maybe. I don't know. I'll have to look that up, Wayne. Does anyone have a study Bible that it says anything on that? This would be looking up verse 13, whether the phrase Hebrew connects with where he lived in Hebron.
It goes from verse 12 to 14, 16. There's nothing about 13.
What does it say?
It skips.
Oh, it skips it. I looked at a number of study Bibles and I didn't see that. And I did not look it up in my regular commentary here.
Well, this reference is in Schofield. He said may be derived from Eber, Abram's ancestor.
Oh, okay. So, but it's taking a guess on that. So I have an excellent commentary here. This is chapter 14, verse 13. Okay. The verse provides a commentary on the moral status of the Sodomites. They were wicked sinners. Nope, that's chapter 13. Okay. I don't want to spend too much on this rabbit trail here. Let's see. More and more scholars are rejecting the equation of Hebrew and Habiru on the historical and philosophical grounds, the development, and he's giving the language here. Then what shall we say of the term Hebrew and elsewhere in the Old Testament? It occurs 33 times in the Old Testament, with the exception of Genesis 14:13 and Jonah 1:9. These references fall into two groups, the time of Joseph and Moses. In other words, what it's saying is we don't know. You know what scholars, they take some three paragraphs to say we don't know. So that's, we don't know, Wayne. I don't know that right now. Okay. So, but it's interesting. This is the first use of the term. So that is worth knowing. Now, Abram was living near the trees of Mamre, the Amorite, a brother of Eshcol and Anir, all of whom were allied with Abram. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out the 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now let's go back to our map, because an interesting question arises. So here's our map.
And he fights this battle. So here's where he was in Hebron. This battle is taking place in the valley of the Dead Sea. So that's this area here. So Abrams finds out that Lot was taken captive, and he chases this army to Dan. That's Dan. So past the Sea of Galilee, all the way up there. As the crow flies from here to here, maybe 60, 70 miles, something like that. But here's the wrinkle. Why would that town be called Dan when Dan has not been born yet? Who's Dan?
One of Judah's sons.
One of Jacob's sons.
Jacob, yeah.
Yeah, one of Jacob's sons. Judah was another one. And the reason is the language of accommodation, because nobody would know what the world he went to, because nobody knows what that land was called. It's like saying, Mary, you used the example, I think, last week. In 1690, the family moved to Chicago. But Chicago was founded, I think, in 1848. But nobody would know if you said settled in whatever that place was called at the time. But everybody knows Chicago. So that is why that is called Dan in the text. And so in other words, that was placed in probably by Moses to just give a word of explanation as to where he went, because it was lost to time. In other words, nobody would know where that was. So that is where they are now heading. And during the night, Abram divided his men to attack them. Now, I want to move up here. Okay. Divided men to attack them, and pursuing them north of Damascus, even further north. He removed all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions together with the women and other people. Now, what stands out of this, how many kings is he going against? Did anyone take note of how many there were?
Five.
So Abram and his 318 elite fighters win. And they not only get Lot back, but they get plunder back. I mean, they are very successful. I pause and I say, why is this story included in the Bible? We have a big, big reason coming up in a moment. But so far, what does this communicate us about Abram? We've already talked about it. The guy is blessed. It's like whatever he touches turns to gold. He wins a battle that he has no business winning. I mean, he is as if he's more powerful than these other kings that won against these other city-states. And yet, he's blessed, you know, time and time again. But now comes the primary reason why this passage is in our Bibles. And this is huge. We read, after Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him, the king of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Sheva, that is the king's valley. So, king of Sodom comes to meet him. However, there's another guy coming out to meet him. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram, saying, blessed be Abram by the God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and praise be to God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hands. Now, who in the world is this guy? So, here is some clues that we get to play with. The word Malek equals just, as in righteous. The word Zedek means he is my king. So, if you put them together, what Melchizedek means is, anyone?
Just my king.
My king is righteous. My king is righteous. So, that's interesting. Then we have a couple other interesting phenomenons here. What is he also? He's a king.
Priest Most High.
He recommends God.
He's a priest.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It says he is a priest. Now he's also a king of what city?
Peace.
Salem,
which very good, is where it's the derivative of Shalom. And so Jerusalem means city of peace. Jeru meaning city, Salem meaning peace. Jerusalem, meaning city of peace, which is in history kind of ironic that Jerusalem is called the city of peace because lots of fighting over that city. But so these are just curious things. Now God receives a whole new set of names, you know, in this particular scenario. So, Melchizedek is the priest of Elyon. He calls God that he's the priest of El Elyon, which is translated in your Bible as God Most High. El meaning God, Elyon meaning Most High. Now this begins a series of new names for God in the book of Genesis. So we are soon going to bump into El Rohi. Roi. Anyone know what that one means? I'll give it to you in a second. Then we're going to bump into the God who is called El Shaddai. Then we're going to bump into the God called El Olam. Each of these have great significance. So, new name for God, first time in our Bibles, right here. God Most High. This one is one of my favorites, El Rohi. This was given by a woman. Her name was Hagar. Why does Hagar give God this name? Because when she's kicked out of the household, she says, God comes to her and she says, you are the God who sees me. Sees me. That's the next name he gets. El Shaddai means Almighty. By the way, Rohi comes up in chapter 16, verse 13, so we're going to get to that soon, next week. Shaddai is going to come up in 17, verse 1, where God is called Almighty, and Olam, El Olam, is in chapter 21, verse 33, where he is the God Everlasting. Everlasting. These are just cool things that everyone kind of like gives their name to God based on what they encounter of God. You are the God who sees me. I mean, that's so beautiful, you know, when you see that and perceive that. So anyway, but right now we introduce it in the King of Salem, brought out bread and wine, kind of like a victory celebration, and he blesses, blessed be Abram by God Most High. Then he gives a description, creator of heaven and earth. So this is not just any local deity of the ancient world. This is creator of heaven and earth. And praise be to God Most High, now, who delivered your enemies into your hand. Who gets the glory? This is a very interesting thing, because normally you put Abram on your shoulders and you say, yeah, you beat the enemy. But Melchizedek says, let's give glory to God. And Abram responds here. It says, then Abram gave him a tenth of everything. Now, here's an interesting language thing. This is implied. Then Abram gave him a tenth of everything. Abram, it says, he gave him a tenth of everything. The question is, who's he? Is it Melchizedek gave him a tenth of everything? Or is it Abram gave him a tenth of everything? You have to figure out who is the subject of the sentence. Now, the NIV solved the problem for us by putting Abram here. Now, why did they put Abram here? What is their logic for it? It's because that Abraham is coming back with all the goodies. And so it's seeming that he is sharing the bounty of what he has received, and therefore he gives 10% to Melchizedek. What's interesting, though, is Melchizedek wasn't part of the group of nations and, you know, everything else. He just, like, shows up out of the blue. So the questions have arisen. Who is this Melchizedek? Now, he's going to show up in Scripture again. First, next place he's going to show up is Psalm 110, verse 1, in which we read, the psalmist says, of David. The Lord says to my Lord, which if you notice, the first one is all capital letters, the next one is small letters. So Yahweh says to Adonai, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. The Lord will extend your mighty scepter from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of your enemies. Your troops will be willing on the day of battle, arrayed in splendor, young men, so on and so forth. Verse 4, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Now, what causes this? At first, when you read the psalm, you're thinking that David is referring to himself. When you're saying, okay, I am going to be blessed of my Lord, but now David is a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek? That makes no sense. This is why the early church interpreted this passage instantaneously as a prediction of Messiah, because he is a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So what book in the New Testament talks most about Melchizedek? Anyone?
Hebrews.
Book of Hebrews. Excellent. So if you take a quick look at Hebrews, the first reference of him is in Hebrews chapter 5, verse 6. And it says here, and it says in another place, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Now, as he is unfolding this, meaning the author of Hebrews, he is equating it, it most assuredly replies to Jesus. So we read this. We have this hope, the anchor of our soul, firm and secure. It enters into the inner sanctuary where our forerunner Jesus has entered on our behalf. He has become a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Then begins his formal discussion. This Melchizedek was king of Salem, priest of God Most High, and he met Abraham at the defeat of the kings and blessed him. And Abraham gave him a tenth of everything he had. First, the name Melchizedek means king of righteousness. Then also king of Salem, which means king of peace, without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning, days or end of life, resembling the Son of God, he remains a priest forever. The author of Hebrews' primary point is that Jesus is a priest, but not in the Levitical type of priest. He is a priest like Melchizedek. The Levitical priests are flawed. Melchizedek is the king of righteousness. And he is a priest in that order, which predates the Levitical priests. He's making a big case. Like Jesus does not have, you know, a father on earth, well, Melchizedek, we don't know his lineage. He just shows up in the text. This has caused many to argue and suggest that what we are seeing in Melchizedek is a Christophany. Now, what is a Christophany? If a theophany is the presence of God with us, Christophany is argued to be a pre-incarnate visitation of God that comes at strategic times, usually equated with the phrase angel of the Lord. Like in a little while, Abraham is going to meet with an angel of the Lord. Now, why is this argued that way? It's because they take on various attributes of God and yet physically present. And since God is spirit and Jesus is the part of the Trinity that is that we can relate to in flesh and blood, the thought is because we know from the New Testament he is pre-eternally existent with the Father, that maybe this is a visitation of none other than Jesus to Abram at this time. And Abram, recognizing something special has happened, gives him 10% and pays homage.
He came with bread and wine.
Yes. That, you know, it's interesting you say that, because that is going to be the Holy Communion, you know, not too long from now.
Foreshadowing.
But it does cause you to pause at the foreshadowing. Now, there are many, you know, scholars who are very cautious about saying that this is a Christophany or, you know, is this Jesus? And they want to be cautious of not pushing the text further than maybe the text is saying. But I think any Christian who has read the book of Hebrews, who has looked at the prophetic words of Psalm 110, must at least raise the question. We know this. Jesus is in the order of Melchizedek, a priestly order of Melchizedek. and we see significant comparisons. Jesus is a king. Jesus is a priest. And he, the fact that it's Jerusalem, I mean, you put these pieces together and we seem to see here a sacred moment. It's a very intriguing passage. It causes you to reflect. It causes you to pause. And I think it should. I think you could, you know, spend a lot of time looking at all the pieces here and reach a fair conclusion that this is a Christophany that has taken place. So let's wrap up our passage and we'll be finished for tonight. So, but Abram said to the king of Sodom, verse 21, I'm sorry. The king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the people and keep the goods for yourself. So, I mean, he's trying to be magnanimous. Hey, you fought the enemies, thank you. Keep the goodies, but give us our people back. I mean, it's a fair statement. But now comes Abram's response. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, with raised hand, I have sworn an oath to the Lord. Now, notice what he does. He quotes it just like Melchizedek did. God Most High, creator of heaven and earth. It's as if Abram just learned something new. And now he's using the very language himself. That I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the strap of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, I made Abram rich. Why is that important? Because Abram's blessing is from God. And he, if the king of Sodom was able to say, I made Abram rich, whose glory is robbed? It's God. And Abram is actually protecting God's glory here. Again, it shows more about the character of the man Abram. I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belongs to the men who went with me. In other words, he does feel that the guys got to get their share. You know, because these 318 guys, they deserve something. But Abram wants nothing to do with it. And what's interesting about this story is that when David is running in the wilderness and he has about 400 fighting men, they have a similar story in where they have to go rescue people. And in that story, David does the exact same thing as Abram. He just shares all the wealth with all the guys. He doesn't take it himself. It's just like David's one of our heroes. Abram is one of our heroes. And you could see both of them are dependent on the Lord and blessed of God for their dependence on the Lord. It's just so intriguing to me. Abram is a picture of dependence upon God. I close with this story from our own church. When you're leading a church, it's very easy to go back to the flesh. What does the Apostle Paul say in Galatians chapter 3? Having begun in the Spirit, how quickly you go back to the flesh. What is the flesh? The flesh is I can earn this myself. That's the flesh. What is the Spirit? I can depend on the Lord. I need to depend on the Lord. I always must depend on the Lord. The problem is we pastors, we like to say we're in the Spirit, but man, we come running back to the flesh. You know what? I try not to find out how many people came to church each week, because if I do, I compare it. Are we more than last year? You know, and I get consumed with numbers, and I've seen pastors obsessed with numbers. Now, I like to see trends, and so I'll spot check periodically what's going on. The other thing is money. What was the offering? I have not asked what an offering was in the entire last year. I never ask. I do look at our budget and see how much is in the general fund. You know, do we have enough to make break even? You know, that kind of thing. I look at that. I need to. It's part of my job. But all of this relates to this principle. Abram was comfortable with Lot getting the best land. Abram is comfortable with not getting any of the treasures. Abram is dependent on the blessing of God. So my last story is this. It's a guy, Alan Bushing. He went home to be with the Lord about a year and 3 months ago. And I loved Alan when he was on my board. Some of you know him from Bible Baptist because he was here for years here in the 70s at this church. But Alan was, when he was on the board, he would look at our budget. And at one point, we had $1.5 million in the bank. And now the reason we had it, because we were about to build this thing. You know, it's going to cost a little money. But he would be at the elder meeting and like slam the table and say, "This is an abomination that we have this much money in the bank." Now, why did he say that? Take a guess.
Not about the money.
What was that?
It's not about the money, it's about God.
It's not about the money, about God, but the danger is you start relying on the money and not on God. The Lord wants his people dependent. He didn't give them the Nile River. He gave them a land dependent on rain. He gave them a land where they're going to have to depend on the Lord for the rest of their lives. A pastor who trained me said these words to me. He said, "Steve, it's a good thing to have the wolf at the door. Because if the wolf is at the door, you depend on the Lord. If you actually think you can pull this off, you depend on yourself." You know one of the richest churches in all of Long Island? It's the Episcopal Church of Oyster Bay. Now, I say this respectfully. I don't mean to denigrate another church. But they have well over $10 million in the bank. Do you hear anything happening at the Episcopal Church of Oyster Bay? About the revivals taking place? About, you know, the many people coming? No, you don't. I think money causes comfort, which causes a lack of dependence. When you are desperate, you need God. And Abram is a man who's learned to depend on the Lord. And every time the Lord comes through again, he builds another altar and said, "The Lord did it." Let's pray. Father, thank you for the example of Abram. Lord, he's going to make his mistakes. We're going to read about them soon. But at this stage, he's pretty impressive. He calls on your name. He builds these altars, remembering key places, key moments in his life. He trusts you. Yeah, he can be weak in faith like when he went to Egypt. And there's a part of me that is kind of glad that he's not perfect. But Father, I see in Abram something that I want to see in me, that I want to see in us as a church, that we are dependent on you for all that we have, so that you would be the only one who can receive glory. We thank you for this. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Amen. Thank you guys for coming. We'll see you next week.